Okay, Barbara, thanks a lot. Our next presentation is by the working group that has been examining the lessons learned for the auditing profession that may be learned by the auditing profession that may be learned from the recent financial crisis. The working group, led by Barbara Roper, includes Michael Head, Damon Silvers, Ann Simpson, and Tony Sondi. I understand that Brandon and Pete Nactway also made contributions to this presentation. When the Investor Advisory Group discussed this topic at its last meeting, it was combined with a discussion of the possible creation of an anti-fraud center at the PCAOB, and some members suggested that such a center could examine not only instances of possible fraud, but also systemic risk to financial reporting beyond fraud. The center then could publish information in an anonymized form that might assist auditors and others to look forward to find where the next fraud or significant market event might occur. The board is continuing to consider the formation of such a center. And with that introduction, Barbara, I turn it over to you, and thank you very much.
Great. And thanks to all of my working group members for their help in putting this together. I'm not going to repeat at length what I said earlier this morning, but I would like to run through and highlight some points. Just basic introduction to the issues that we were trying to address as part of this working group. Our basic assumption is that auditors, or perhaps it's fairer to say audits, failed to perform their basic public watchdog function in the financial crisis. And we believe that there's a need to figure out why they failed to perform that function and what can be done to fix that problem. We thought we fixed it when we passed Sarbanes-Oxley Act. We sought to make auditors more independent and to give audit committees more control over the audit, with the idea that that would make auditors more willing to stand up to management in their review of financial reports. We created the Public Accounting Oversight Board to raise the standards for auditors and hold auditors accountable for meeting those standards, in the hopes that that would improve the quality of audits, and that together these would give investors financial statements that they could rely on to give them the information they were looking for when they invested in public companies. The recent financial crisis, in essence, provided the first major massive test of the effectiveness of those Sarbanes-Oxley Act reforms. And, you know, by any objective measure, at least from the point of view of investors, they failed that test. This is just a sampling of the financial institutions, major global financial institutions, that failed or were sold in fire sales or were prevented from failing by virtue of massive government intervention, all of which had received unqualified audit opinions within months of the failure. And as you see, all of the audit firms represented with clients on that list. And I think the point that Damon made earlier is exactly the right one. If the auditors were performing as they should, and this is the result we get, then there's a problem with the system that says that's an appropriate audit. It may not be a problem with the auditor. That's why I said earlier it may be fairer to say that audits rather than auditors failed to perform their function. But I think it's impossible to look at that list and not at least raise questions about whether auditors didn't play a fairly significant role in the financial crisis. Some of the obvious areas, did their failure to adequately test valuations help companies to hide significant information? Did their deteriorating financial condition from investors? PCAOB inspectors found that auditors in some cases were not adequately testing valuations. How did that play into the financial crisis? Did they allow companies inappropriately to hire risks off balance sheet? Again, PCAOB inspectors found that in some cases they were not adequately testing whether it was appropriate for those to be treated as off-balance sheet assets. So, you know, what role did that play in causing the financial crisis? Did they agree to, or perhaps even help to design, transactions whose sole purpose was to hide from investors the degree of leverage that companies were taking on? And if the answer to those questions is yes, and many have suggested that the answer to those questions is yes, it at the very least raises concerns that, as the UK Financial Services Authority said, they showed a worrying lack of professional skepticism. But if the answer to those questions is yes, it may not only have deprived shareholders of information, but contributed to a situation in which lack of transparency helped to freeze the credit markets and really worsened the financial crisis. So this is a significant issue that needs to be addressed. As I said earlier, we're told that part of the problem here is an expectations gap. Investors have unreasonable expectations about what they can expect from the audits of public companies. I provided some, and you have in your packets, some of the things that have been written by independent observers, which express a high degree of frustration, anger, cynicism, that's really troubling, you know, as a statement about the lack of investor confidence in financial reporting and auditors of financial reports, and even raise questions about whether the audit itself, if it can't do a better job, has become irrelevant. And contrast that with statements from some of the audit firms themselves, which express less concern, shall we say. And in fact, in some cases, seem to express a degree of complacency about the current situation. And if this is indeed the best we can expect from audits, it does really raise significant questions about what the value to shareholders is, investors is, of, you know, the audited financial statements. For the most part, at least in this country, the auditors have sort of escaped repercussions. They haven't gotten a lot of attention from Congress, which, as I say, has largely proved to be a good thing, given what Congress chose to do in this area. And the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, you know, had sort of its hands full with all of the issues it was supposed to address. There is actually, if you look for it, quite a bit of information in the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report that is interesting. If your concern is about lack of transparency on financial reports, if your concern is about some of the relationships that appear to have existed between auditors and some of the companies and the role of this. And in the slides, I've highlighted a few of the cases. The report gives most attention to the issue of AIG, Goldman Sachs, and PricewaterhouseCoopers, which was auditor to both of those firms. And there are some sort of interesting and, at least to me, kind of shocking things that you come across if you dig into that report, like the fact that at the point when Goldman Sachs started pushing AIG for collateral, AIG Financial Products didn't have a model or otherwise try to value the CDO portfolio that it guaranteed through credit default swaps. So the company had an exposure of $79 billion, and the parent company's, you know, total reported capital is $95.8 billion. They don't have a model for valuing that exposure, and that seemed to be fine. They got no questions, apparently, from their auditor about that problem. And, in fact, their auditor, like many of the executives at the company, didn't even know that there were collateral provisions in these contracts. So, you know, this huge risk that ultimately brought down the company that isn't apparently on anybody's radar screen, that would seem to be relevant information. And And then the other sort of event specific to this audit that was highlighted in that report is that the auditor, to its credit, had started raising some serious questions about the risk management practices, the valuation practices at AIG. They had concluded that, and they had serious problems with a value that AIG had reported to shareholders in December about taking a negative basis adjustment to reduce from $5.1 billion to $1.5 billion their loss estimate from their CDOs. But they let that disclosure go out to investors in December. It wasn't until February that they brought it up with the board. And, you know, I have to ask, along with the FCIC, you know, why the auditors waited so long to make this pronouncement, that there was a material weakness in their controls, is unclear, particularly given that PwC had known about the adjustment in November. So November to February, they know about it, they're concerned about the controls, but they let that information go out to shareholders. So those, you know, as I say, so there's some things that have come out, and then there's another in the report. They also, not in the report itself, but on the website, there's a document with regard to Citigroup that raises some serious questions about the role of the auditor, given that a week after Citigroup had gotten a report from the OCC that their controls were a mess, they put out a financial statement that said everything's fine, and the auditor signed it and attested to the quality of controls. That strikes me as another area we could stand to get, you know, better insight into, you know, how common were those practices, why? I mean that's the big question in all of this, that I think, why does that happen? And then, as I said, the PCAOB has done its own report, and it actually, you know, it is a useful document. It provides some very beneficial information, you know, insights into some of the problems that occurred that logically one might expect played a role in the financial crisis, the problems that the inspectors found with regard to fair value measurement and off-balance sheet structures being sort of at the top of the list of seeming like areas that deserve more study. But that report is just a starting point, in our view. There are a couple of reasons. Its focus is on the effect of the financial crisis on audits rather than the role of audits in the financial crisis. It prevents its information in very generalized terms, and most importantly, it identifies where auditors fail to perform up to standards, but it does not attempt to analyze why those failures occurred or what needs to be done to prevent or minimize the chances of a recurrence. So, as I say, it provides a valuable starting point for the kind of further review that we think is necessary, but a starting point only. So, as I said, in this country, there's been relatively little attention to these issues up to this point. You have to sort of dig for the nuggets in other documents, but we think a more in-depth study needs to be done. Anne is going to talk a little bit about what's going on in the EU and the UK, where they have begun to look much more extensively about some of these issues that we think should be delved into in this country as well.
Thanks very much, Barbara. Well, thank you to the whole of this group. We had some very good discussions, and I must say, Barbara, thank you very much for leading it, because it was not an easy crowd to get together and an almost impossible task. You know, what went wrong? Why did it go wrong? What should the PCAOB be doing about it? So I think Barbara set the scene very well for what our concerns are. And my task, at Steve Harris's suggestion, is to take a look at what's being done internationally, give you some of the highlights, and we hope this presents a menu of ideas for the PCAOB, because these big questions about why the watchdogs didn't bark. These questions are being asked in other jurisdictions, but the US is the largest capital market in the world. It's the market where the home market for the big four audit firms, and it's just phenomenally important that the PCAOB takes this agenda up. So, you know, our congratulations to the appointment to the new board members. We really think this is an important issue. So in just a few minutes, what I'd like to do is give you a flavour for the different initiatives that are there. We've put together a six-inch file of these various projects that are going on internationally. And for that, I'd like to thank Mary Morris and her team at CalPERS for doing the background work. But if anyone is interested in the projects that I'm going to refer to, please let me know. We'd be delighted to send you the links. So the first thing I want to say is that there are at least a dozen different inquiries that have been launched in different countries. And I'm only going to talk about Europe. All due respect to Asia, Latin America, and other parts of the world, this really is a European discussion. And I just want to read off the titles of some of them to give you a sense of the scope. So the Financial Reporting Council, their project, Enhancing Corporate Reporting and Audit, a separate report on auditor skepticism, the Auditing Practices Board, ethical standards for auditors, again, the FRC, audit committees and non-audit services, and then an audit firm governance code issued by the Institute of Chartered Accountants in England and Wales, which is really trying to get at this whole agenda of the governance of the audit networks without having to wait for some global legislative initiative. So there's been a very wide and diverse range of activity, but I think the key inquiry is being led by the European Commission, which has issued a green paper towards the end of last year, which was framed on the theme of lessons learned from the financial crisis-audit policy. And I just want to give you the full quote, which Steve touched on earlier, which Michel Barnier, the European Commissioner, who's responsible for this, conveyed a real sense of urgency when this, in February, just last month, when this project had an open meeting on all the submissions they'd gathered so far. And this is what he said. The title of his speech was Audit 2011, and in French, the title was L'année de l'audace, which I think loosely translates into the audit as audacity. But he sees this, I would say, as a loose translation, as time to get on with it. And no holds barred. This is an opportunity for a root and branch, fresh look at what's going on the audit. So this is how the paper is framed. He says, and this was what Steve mentioned earlier, the status quo is not an option for the auditing world. It's not about changing for the sake of change, but to reply to the very real needs which we can no longer ignore. So there's a discussion which will seem very familiar to the United States about what went wrong and how shocking it was that nothing was mentioned in audit reports. However, I think what's interesting about this project, and maybe for the PCAOB worth looking at, and our investor group would certainly encourage you to go in this direction, is how broadly they're framing their questions. So let me give you some examples, certainly the ones that caught my eye. On the audit industry, first question. This isn't their language in the question. Please understand, this is me giving you highlights. I'm sure they do have a far more subtle way of putting it. This is my take as an investor of what they're asking. So first of all, how have the global big four firms become a systemic risk in themselves? And the question that follows from that, do we need to take measures to introduce the equivalent of living wills or measures too big to fail, which obviously have been preoccupying reform initiatives around financial institutions? And in that regard, they're interested in this idea of living wills. What would that look like for the big, for another collapse of an audit firm? And transitional support, for example, through joint audits or a move to audit consortia. So that to me is a very eye-popping thought and something really worth thinking about. Their second big question, which is about the way audit firms are currently organized, has the partnership model reached its limit? Is it time for both restructuring and also downsizing? It's another part of addressing their concerns about systemic risk with the Big Four. And that would also be an opportunity, they think, for us to consider allowing new corporate forms to be developed, raise capital, and help with entry for new players. Third big issue that they put on the table, is the supervisory system truly independent of the audit firms? Parts of the standard-setting world are receive funding directly from and also have representative seats for members of the audit profession, and they would really like to look at that again and see whether it compromises independence. Another fundamental question, should auditing ever be provided alongside other commercial services? Should auditing even be a commercial service? They pose the question, in certain circumstances, should the audit actually be conducted by a non-commercial body? Should it be a regulatory or a supervisory body that goes in to do the audit, for example, of systemically important financial institutions? So we cannot criticise Barnier for being timid. This is no shrinking violet there in Brussels. But there's more. Let's turn now to what they're asking about the role of the auditor, sort of taking the whole industry. There's a whole section of the inquiry which is about the industry itself. Next thing, about the role of the auditor. And here are a few highlights from the questions that they're asking. So, have we got to a situation where the reasonable assurance provided by auditors is less concerned with risk, which is what it's meant to have been concerned with, and more concerned with simple conformity to standards? And have we gone, we've lost substance over form, an issue that was touched on earlier. Secondly, should the audit methodology be communicated to stakeholders? Note, interesting, as this is Europe, it's not shareholders, it's stakeholders. And in particular, and I think this is very interesting, thinking about Damon's comment about valuations on you know, around mortgages and mortgage securitization and derivatives products run from those. Should we in particular have substantive verification of the balance sheet, which is part of a bigger question they're asking about getting audit, should we be thinking about audit going, as they put it, back to basics, rather than focusing on processes, which perhaps are more properly the task of management. So that's, they're not answering the question, but they're asking it. They also have a section on auditor behaviour. This is sort of auditor anthropology, I suppose. What could be done to foster professional scepticism? And part of that, obviously, is independence and objectivity, which we've touched on. Part of it is training. Part of it is reward and incentives. But it is a behavioural question. It's not something that, that you can define easily. And also they spend some time asking questions which we have touched on here about how do we move away from an up or down yes-no answer with the audit opinion. And they do actually ask some interesting questions about if you did have an auditor's discussion and analysis, you don't want a lot of fluff. You do want something useful. You don't want to stray into being vague again. So there's some real discussion around that. And finally, they do flag up, should auditors also be opining on material, environmental and social risks? And I think we've seen companies, you know, even in the US, where the risks being run on environmental issues have proven to be material. So that does, of course, pose a question about what the auditors might be doing about that. So let me just finish with their wrap-up questions, which if we could find a group of ideas or issues for the PCOB to tackle, I suggest it would be captured in this less than a dozen questions. So first, do you believe that audits should provide comfort on the financial health of companies, and are audits fit for such a purpose? So to bridge the expectation gap and in order to clarify the role of audit, should the audit methodology employed be better explained to users? Thirdly, should professional scepticism be reinforced, and how could this be achieved? Fourth, should the negative perception attached to qualification in audit reports be reconsidered, and if so, how? Is there adequate and regular dialogue between the external, internal auditors and the audit committee? We touched on that in Anne's discussion. If not, how can it be improved? Do you think auditors should play a role in ensuring the reliability of information companies are reporting in the field of corporate social responsibility? Should there be more regular communication by the auditor to the stakeholders, and should the time gap between the year end and the date of the audit opinion be reduced? And then my favourite, which I think could keep everyone occupied for a very long time, what other measures could be envisaged to enhance the value of audits, which I'd be fascinated when they do publish their comments to see what else people came up with. So I think I would recommend this particular initiative at the European Commission to the PCAOB board for consideration. Chunks of it are not relevant. They're about how do people in Finland go and audit companies in Germany and, you know, all manner of things very particular to Europe. But I think what I find valuable is the willingness to put everything on the table, even if they don't have the answers, and to have a very broad-ranging inquiry to see what might come back. They're planning to come back with proposals later this year, but I certainly think we might. I'm sure you're already in touch with your counterparts in the European Commission on these issues, but I'm sure they'd find it valuable to, you know, be helping shape the agenda that we hope the PCAOB will take up. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Tony?
I've been tasked with giving you a sense of the recommendations from our working group, but I wanted to make two points before I get into that. Barbara, in her excellent job earlier, was talking about the AIG reported capital, and she mentioned that 80% of it was so-and-so. I wonder how many people are aware that of the AIG Financial Products unit, the unit that actually imploded, roughly 80% of its capital actually came from the deferred compensation of the CEO of that unit. How much comfort do you think an investor derives from the fact that 80% of the capital that stands behind the company comes from the deferred compensation of the CEO? The second point that I want to make is that if you think about disclosures and what's happening with them, recognition and measurement today is insufficient to provide an adequate picture. So the numbers that you see in a set of financial statements, the only way to understand them, I think, is to be able to read the footnotes and understand what they're talking about. So if you have footnotes that are boilerplate and you have footnotes that are not being audited, there's an extraordinary amount of a gap in there. That deficiency, I think, is rather significant. I think I've mentioned this before here. When I first went to the EITF at the FASB, I made a comment that in coming up to the building, I had seen a sign outside that said that accounting is not discussed after 4 p.m. on Fridays. And below it, it said that disclosure, however, cannot be discussed before 4:30 p.m. on Fridays. I wonder what that similar sign is for the auditors. Does it mention when or whether they even talk about disclosures? And I want to be very clear. I'm not talking about the people from the accounting firms who serve on the EITF or go on to serve on the FASB. I know they are aware of disclosures. I'm talking about the field auditors. What are the processes that they follow about with respect to disclosures, with respect to auditing those? And I think that's where we're finding some of the problems. Now to the recommendations. Our first recommendation is that the PCAOB launch an in-depth study into the role of the auditors and the audit, as you've clarified, in the financial crisis, as enablers maybe of the financial crisis. I think the objective, the objective should be that we need to identify the causes of the pervasive audit failures and then propose and, in a timely fashion, implement remedies to those. The working group also recommends that the PCAOB make this in-depth analysis an ongoing part of your process. Another set of recommendations or thoughts, I think it's time to revisit SOP 94-6 on disclosures of significant risks and uncertainties. I think if you think about the fact that that particular disclosure requirement didn't really help us very much with this last crisis, maybe we need to update that and take a look at it. I think, for example, if you look at, as Lynn had mentioned, Enron, WorldCom, and some of the other companies that were part of or responsible for the crisis, earlier crisis, I should say, those disclosures did tell you a fair amount. But you had to go through them. You had to read them. But they did not, no matter how well you analyze those, they did not give you the full scale of the problems. So I think we need to do something about 94-6. I think we need to reconsider the audit procedures as they relate to liquidity, financial flexibility, and off-balance sheet financial statement assets and liabilities. So I'm expanding it from risks, not just the off-balance sheet risks. And this, again, with respect to financial flexibility, the off-balance sheet, I remember organizing a conference about off-balance sheet risks in 1984. And Lynn had pointed out earlier that one hopes that 7 years would be sufficient. But I've actually done an analysis, Lynn. If it takes the FASB 7.5 years, they normally don't reach a conclusion. One outlier on that is control and consolidations, which they quit after 23.5 years. So I think that we need to look at those. By the way, I'm not making these numbers up. You can actually look them up if you want. And then finally, I think another point that has been made before, and specifically by Lynn, and that is we need to be very, very clear about where and what the responsibilities of the PCAOB, for example, are when inspections turn up problems with the application of the accounting standards. We need to be very, very clear because that's one of the most difficult areas. Is the problem with the way the standard was written? Is the problem the way it's being implemented? Or is it an issue of audits? And I'm not suggesting that it's always going to be straightforward, and that may be one of the most difficult recommendations to consider. But I think it's critical, and I certainly will be happy to answer any questions.
Just two small points. We were well aware that the board, like any organization, has its own resource limitations, and we're not privy to the internal investigations that the board is undertaking. But despite the potential breadth of the postmortem that we described, we do think it's critical that we undertake such an inquiry, not with a view toward necessarily assigning blame, but literally with a view toward trying to learn what we need to do to change things on a going forward basis, so that to the extent the board feels it's necessary to skinny down or otherwise target the breadth of what we've described, we do think that that inquiry is worthwhile, or otherwise it will just drift into dust. But we recognize that there will be resource limitations, and we don't think that duplication is appropriate. Second, we debated, as Tony's careful remarks highlighted, what we recognize to be the potential boundary issues between standard setting and implementation. We think, if anything, those boundary issues argue for this inquiry. Because when you have a split between standard setters and enforcers, as you will, there is enormous potential for gaps to develop. The standard setters may or may not appreciate what the enforcers are finding, and the enforcers may feel limited in their ability to make recommendations regarding standard setting. So if anything, we thought that that split argues for taking a very careful assessment of what did happen on the ground, potentially with a view toward either making recommendations with respect to standard setting or enhancing the coordination between standard setters and fact finders. So that rather than be a limitation on such an inquiry, we see it as an opportunity to enhance the flow of information between and the benefits from coordination between standard setters and fact finders.